It's not an option. It's a right. Cocked, locked, and ready to rock the world of the anti-gunners. You are listening to the guy who had to register his mouth as a full auto weapon. Bill Carnes and Two-Way Radio. The fight for your rights isn't for pansies. So buckle up for the ride and knuckle down with Bill Carnes and 2A Radio.
Boom. Hello, America. I'm your host, Bill Carnes. You're tuned in right here to the Second Amendment Radio Show. We'd like to shorten that down and just call it 2A Radio. Of course, the website is 2aradio.com. You can find all the news and information about the show. Certainly all of the archives for the past 2+ years that we have been on the air coast to coast. In our new 2-hour weekend format. Formerly Monday through Friday, 1-hour a day show on various networks. Now we're down to 2 hours on a Sunday as we broadcast. Let's see, it is 9 a.m. Pacific time, noon Eastern, if you're listening to the initial broadcast. Couple of big things going on this weekend. First of all, first and foremost, in my life, a couple of birthdays are happening today. My mother's birthday is today, and my eldest daughter's birthday is today. 21 years ago today, I presented my mom with a granddaughter for her birthday. They share the same day. And of course, my daughter being 21, this is a big celebratory weekend for her. She has lived a pretty varied and interesting life. Her mother and I split up when she was about a year and a half old. She doesn't even remember the two of us together. And that was unfortunate for her. However, her mom's gone on and done a lot of things. She's lived in Australia. As a matter of fact, she's living in Australia now. She's lived in Germany. My daughter's lived with her in both Germany and Australia, as well as Texas and Florida. So she's got to move around a bit. She's certainly got to travel around Europe a few times. Done a lot of things, gone a lot of places that I haven't even gone. And I'm her dad. I'm twice her age. Well, a little less than twice her age now, as long as she's been around. That and, of course, my mother, who lives up in the green state of Oregon. Actually, she and her husband are looking to retire someday in the next 2 or 3 years and probably move on from there. They've been in Oregon for about 7 or 8 years now. 8 or 9 years now, I think, actually. Nice little spot up there. Not far out of the Eugene area. But anyhow, my mother and my daughter both have birthdays today. So happy birthday to both of you. I love you both very much. Also this weekend, we have in Pittsburgh is the NRA convention. Now, having been a contestant on Top Shot Season 1, the Season 1 cast keeps it in contact through an email form that we have. And it's interesting because, quite honestly, I was so busy in the past month. A little over a month, with the 3-day precision rifle class coming up and several other things I've been getting on, trying to accomplish ever since we switched to a weekend format from a daily format. I've been trying to catch up on a lot of things that were, quite honestly, being neglected. I hadn't seen an episode of Top Shot. It was a 12-episode season for Season 2. I haven't seen beyond Episode 6 of this season. I was 6 episodes back. So as it turns out, on Wednesday of this week, I was just plain ill. Not feeling good at all. As a matter of fact, feeling downright horrible. The reason is, Tuesday night, I took a detox tea. Just because I've been cleaning up my diet. I've lost about 15 pounds in the past month. I've been doing the right thing. So I take this very powerful detox diet, and it says only half. Well, you know, hey, I'm a big tough guy. I've done this sort of thing before. I can have the whole tea. Well, all the toxins got into my bloodstream, and then I had to pump them out. I felt horrible on Wednesday. I saw 5 of the 6 Top Shot episodes I hadn't seen. The one I haven't seen, the final episode. Still today, I don't know who actually ended up winning Top Shot Season 2. I've been keeping myself at bay from it, at distance. And, of course, the Season 1 cast through this email setup that we've got, there's been about probably 25 emails all around. And I haven't read a single one because I don't want to spoil the surprise. I have not been participating. And normally I do. I'm normally very participatory in this email forum setup that we've got. But the Top Shot Season 1 and Season 2 winner, Season 1 Ian Harrison, Season 2 whoever that is, I don't know yet. I was sick and I caught up and then I couldn't do it anymore. I was just feeling too lousy. I could not actually stand to stay awake for the last hour and watch Top Shot finale. Anyhow, not much of an ambassador of a Season 2 show when it comes to hearing this news out there in Radioland. Anyhow, those two guys are together at the Crimson Trace booth. Ian Harrison, after winning Top Shot Season 1, being the Top Shot, got a job as the PR director for Crimson Trace up in Oregon, where he's from. And they're going to be together at the NRA convention. Of course, if you've listened to the show for any time whatsoever, you know that I am not a huge fan of the way the NRA, in the last 25 years or so, has really become an organization of compromise at the legislative level, at the NRA-ILA. In fact, the current Brady Law that's on the books since the early 90s, the NRA wrote. They saw something coming down the pike, and rather than fight it, they decided to try to mitigate it. They wrote it and said, this is what we won't fight. This is what we'll accept. So a compromise. And it's been getting worse and worse and worse ever since. So not a big fan. Unless the NRA convention ever happens to be held in the town in which I reside at the time I reside there, I will probably not be attending. I don't want to say never. Never say never. I will probably not attend. Unless or until the NRA drops the compromise. Anyhow, that's going on in Pittsburgh. As a matter of fact, I believe it is shoring up today. I believe today is the last day of the convention. On this week's show, we're going to talk a little bit about the Massachusetts Supreme Court refusing a challenge to the state's law dealing with guns, one of the state laws dealing with guns, hence ignoring the Supreme Court ruling in both the Heller and McDonald decisions. This, of course, will go to the circuit court over Massachusetts. I believe it's the Second Circuit. The Brady campaign is all over to ban what they're calling assault clips. Just hearing that and knowing anything about nomenclature, firearms, and ammunition holders, you know they don't know what they're talking about. Seattle cop we talked about a year ago in a beating is now involved in another police cover-up with a video. This guy just has a storied history. And an armed judge out of Florida has to confront deputies in her own front yard. You'll enjoy hearing about this. All these sorts of things and more coming up in this week's show. Stay tuned. I'm your host, Bill Carnes. You're tuned in right here to 2A Radio.
Irresponsible people have no business owning a gun or listening to this show. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes is back.
Hi guys, welcome back. Okay, so the Massachusetts Supreme Court has rebuffed a Second Amendment challenge. The Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts has rejected a challenge to the constitutionality of state statutes criminalizing carrying a firearm without a license and possessing a firearm without an identification card. Now, keep in mind, in the Heller decision out of the U.S. Supreme Court of June 2008, Justice Scalia wrote that carrying an exposed firearm throughout the U.S. is legal and a guaranteed right by the Second Amendment. That's what he says. Carrying a loaded firearm is legal And, of course, that was incorporated in the McDonald decision 2 years later, not quite a year ago now, June of 2010. Now, the challenge was brought by a defendant who contended that the statutes unlawfully deny persons between 18 and 20 years of age from obtaining the same means of self-protection as 21-year-old adults. Now, the Supreme Justice Judicial Court, SJC, however, declined to address the merits of the assertion, noting that the record did not indicate that the defendant ever attempted to obtain a license or FID card, firearms identification card. Quote, instead of applying for an FID card, the defendant chose to violate the law, said Justice Roderick L. Ireland, who wrote for the unanimous court. This is just a scapegoat slithering way to get away from addressing the actual argument in the court. As was the case in an FID card, the defendant does not contend that he attempted to obtain a license to carry, the judge continued, by saying, as a consequence, the defendant has not demonstrated that a denial of the issuance of a 131 license to him would have been rendered on account of his age alone. Ireland added that the U.S. Supreme Court precedent, particularly District of Columbia v. Heller, we talked about, quote, stands for the proposition that the same categorical bans on firearm possession or use are constitutional, including regulations concerning who may possess a right to keep and bear arms. So, kind of a flaw in the way that they're looking at it. What Ireland is saying, that there's regulations on who may possess a right. Okay, if there's regulations on a right, that means it's no longer a right, it's a privilege. You see what I'm saying? So the Massachusetts Supreme Court has basically taken the easy way out, which courts do all the time. They're saying this guy didn't even attempt to get a license to carry a gun. So for him to say that because he was arrested and charged with carrying a gun without a license, he didn't even bother trying to obtain one. Well, factually, one of two things should have happened in my eyes in this case. Either the kid should have tried to get the card first, and then when denied, filed a suit, as the court says, or challenged the law, challenged his arrest on the standing alone that, hey, I don't need to get a card because of this decision in Heller and its incorporation in this decision here in McDonald. I don't need a card. It's unconstitutional. And, as that was a decision handed down by the Supreme Court of the United States, a higher court than this, you are commanded by law that you must take notice. So, that's the way that goes. The lower courts have to take notice of a higher court decision. They have to. Now, do they always? No, which is why you have to appeal it higher up. Some judges just don't want to listen to judges that are sitting a little bit higher on the totem pole of justice than they are. Now, I'll tell you something that happened with me, judicially speaking, if we can even call it that. And I'll tell you the story. Around 18 months ago or so, I got a parking citation in the city of Las Vegas. I went downtown, parked on a street, and that particular day, I did not have license plates on my car. What I had was a little dealer plates on my car. My car was registered, and I own license plates, but I had dealer plates on the car. The reason is, I had just driven to Arizona. I was in Arizona for the weekend, driven into Arizona and driven back. And they have photo radar, which I've gotten photo radar from Arizona before. They take a picture. They send me a ticket in the mail. I throw it away. I just decided to avoid all that. So I put the dealer plates on there. Photo radar is a sham. It's been ruled that it's unenforceable. There's all kinds of problems with it. So I just put dealer plates on there. I did not take the dealer plates off the day that I got back. The next day, I'm in Las Vegas. So I'm parked on the street outside of this attorney's office, which is a renovated house, just the way things go downtown in Vegas. It's these older, cool little homes. they actually renovate out, and there's most of them are attorney's officers, dentists, all kinds of stuff. So I'm in there talking with this guy, come out, and there's a parking ticket on my car. And it has a violation from the Las Vegas Municipal Code, which is not really a law. It is a city ordinance. And it says it's a parking violation, it's $50, but if I pay right now within the next 5 days, it's only $25. Well, forget you. I went home, I looked up the code, and it says on the code, any vehicle parked within the city of Las Vegas must display valid registration from the Nevada Department of Motor Vehicles. Now, the way that they wrote this, the meter maid, took my VIN number. Unfortunately, I didn't have a little envelope covering it, which I normally do, but I didn't. Would have rendered them useless. Anyhow, I look it up and I realize, wow, that means anybody who parks within the city of Las Vegas, if they have registration from any other state, are technically in violation of this city ordinance. Well, that's unconstitutional. So I found all of the constitutional authorities by courts, by the Nevada State Supreme Court, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals over Nevada, and the U.S. Supreme Court. I cited 10 separate cases of higher authority. I ended up sending this in to the city. And it's one of these things where they have an independent attorney look at all these things, and I said, You are required by law to take notice of the higher court's rulings. By this time, the thing had gone on and gone on. They wanted $250, whatever. So I got a letter back, and it says, we took notice, and we're going to lower your fine to $85. Little do they know, the paperwork that I filled out and sent in to them, I remanufactured it. I wasn't happy with the words in the verbatim that they said. You will abide by blah. No, not at all. So I rewrote the different forms and sent them in. And these forms said, under no circumstances, by any measure of the imagination whatsoever, are the rulings by whatever magistrate is assigned by the city in this case, bound by law in any way, shape, or form whatsoever. And the city, by accepting this and hearing this by the appointed magistrate, agrees to completely hold harmless the defendant, me, and at no time whatsoever will their decision be binding. So, of course, they send me this thing. I ignore it. I get a letter that says, hey, you need to pay up. So I sent them a letter back, and I said, you need to read that paperwork very carefully. Let me include a copy of what you accepted. And I highlighted the areas of importance and sent it in. I haven't heard from them since. That's been about 9 months. Scumbags. Anyhow, just a little kicker in there on top of the way the magistrates at the state level, state Supreme Court in Massachusetts, looked at things. Beat them at their own game. Stay tuned, guys. There is more to come. We're going to talk about the new Brady campaign to completely screw people out of guns after the break. We'll be right back.
You're listening to a guy who packs a gun to shoot the bad guys and packs a mic to shoot his mouth off. Bill Carnes and 2A Radio are back.
All right, guys, welcome back from the break. The Brady campaign to completely screw all of America out of their gun rights and trample the Second Amendment, I believe that's her official name, has a new push to ban what they're calling assault clips. Now, let's talk a little bit about nomenclature. Anybody who knows anything about the nomenclature of ammunition holders knows that there are two different types. There are clips and there are magazines. They are different. They are mutually exclusive items. They serve a similar purpose, but the design of which and the application of which are used differently. Essentially, clips load magazines. If it's encompassed, if it encompasses the bullet and has a spring underneath the rounds, pushing the rounds, it's a magazine. If it merely retains the back edge of the round from a piece of sprung steel, it is a clip. A clip is used to load a magazine. If you have an internal box magazine, like on an M1 Garand, the way that works is you lock the bolt back, put the clip into holding a little spot that's held by the open bolt, and you push the rounds down into the internal box magazine. Pull the charging handle back, the clip pops out, the magazine of the gun is full, and you go. You can load an AR-15 magazine with 10-round stripper clips. Clips and magazines are different. Okay? Just so you understand. A number of people don't understand. Certainly anti-gunners don't. Because they are so enthralled with their own anti-gunism, they never learn what it is they're arguing against. Which is a huge problem I have. Here's the deal. If you are so passionate about a subject, pro or against, and you have no experience with that particular topic itself, then your argument is mute. It is absolutely mute. And I use this example. If somebody stands up at the top of their lungs and they decry that they absolutely despise BMW cars, how horrible they are, they suck, they don't drive well, they stink, they're on whatever they might say against a BMW because they hate them. Yet they've never even driven or even been in a BMW. Well, they're completely ignorant and their point is moot. So, my entire idea of this would be, you go grab yourself a BMW, give it to this person, and say, here's the keys, it's got a full tank of gas, and here's a gas card for the weekend. Go spend the next couple of days driving this car. Put at least 300-500 miles on it. Then come back, and then I want to hear your opinion about BMWs. Okay. At the conclusion of that, if the person actually gives it an honest run, puts a good couple hundred, few hundred miles on it, then that person can have a legitimate opinion, provided they actually normally drive anyhow. Then their opinion is worth something. It's worth their weight in salt. People who are anti-gun and vehemently anti-gun, who've never shot, never held a gun, never gone through any training, their argument is absolutely worthless. Absolutely worthless. People who are absolutely, positively against any one thing, and they have never had any experience with it, are ignorant. That's the way it is. They're ignorant. Now, if they take their information, as most anti-gunners do, off of what they see on the news, that only if it bleeds, it leads. If it lives, they don't care about it. But if it bleeds, it leads. They'll talk about all the negative stuff with guns. And that's what people will start to believe is actually the truth. That and what they see on TV and movies and television programs. So, the Brady campaign doesn't even have the nomenclature proper. Let's see. The Brady campaign to prevent gun violence and screw America out of their Second Amendment rights has renewed its attack on firearms parts, releasing a new TV commercial as part of their efforts to encourage President Obama to take stronger action to ban assault clips. You know what an assault clip is, right? Like those used in the shooting rampage in Tucson that left 6 dead and 13 injured in just 16 seconds. In breathless prose, the Brady press release outlined their campaign against the latest national menace, describing their new commercial as part of a campaign to show, quote, in valid fashion, end quote, the danger all Americans face from assault clips. A tried and true method of turning out the media, the photo opportunity, was also announced. Kelly O'Brien, fiance of Gabe Zimmerman, the congressional staffer who was killed in last year's shooting rampage, as they say, was set to appear yesterday at a Hill press conference with the two co-sponsors of legislation to ban assault clips, Senator Frank Lautenberg, scumbag, anti-liberty representative out of New Jersey, and Carolyn McCarthy, scumbag, anti-gun, anti-liberty, anti-American representative out of New York. And the presser O'Brien was going to call on President Obama to step up and push a ban on assault clips. I've never actually seen or even heard of an actual clip that has the capacity to fire a bullet or even holds more than 10 bullets itself. If you know of either, please email me, bill@2aradio.com. I want to hear about it and see pictures. Let's see, if you've followed the continuing efforts of anti-gun members of Congress, of course, the names of McCarthy and of Lautenberg are more than familiar. These two have never met a gun restriction that they don't like. Despite the fact that Representative McCarthy's ardor is fueled by another senseless attack that shattered her world, she's not let facts get in the way of her burning desire to see firearms, all of them, if she were honest, collected from citizens and destroyed. Having seen their commercial, it's obvious that the Brady campaign is working to sell more fear into a society that's already living in a constant state of turmoil. But you have to give the Brady campaign their props for the commercial. They might be arguing against a non-existent object, assault clips, but they make the fear point by rapidly firing a handgun into targets that change to different silhouettes with each shot. None of us have anything to fear from any ammunition-bearing device outside of a firearm. Without a firearm, a magazine, whether it holds one or 1,000 rounds, is the equivalent of staples without a stapler. And more people get injured by staples and bullets in this country anyhow. No ammo-bearing device is a malevolent entity capable of running a firearm with no human assistance. Neither is a higher capacity magazine capable of turning anyone into a crazed killer. Crazy is brought into a firearm, not the other way around. So Brady, try to learn a thing or two, you ignorant goofballs. Stay tuned, more to come after the break. I'm your host, Bill Carnes, on 2A Radio. If you live in a state which allows Class 3 NFA firearms and accessories, and you either have an interest in or already own Class 3 NFA items, the process for an individual to own these items includes photographs, fingerprints, obtaining a letter of permission from your police chief or sheriff, and a full personal background check which is spread across the whole federal system. Until now. Forming an NFA trust eliminates the requirements of letters of permission and all personal data and background checks in purchasing and possessing NFA firearms and accessories. NFA trusts offer a level of anonymity as well as flexibility in the purchasing, possessing, and storage of your Class 3 NFA firearms and accessories. To learn more about forming a secure and flexible NFA trust at a fraction of the cost earned from attorneys, visit www.billcarnes.com and click on the NFA tab. That's BILLCARNS.com and click on the NFA tab.
You can have the alcohol and tobacco. Leave the firearms to us. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes is back.
And welcome back from the break, everyone. Now, I am a former cop. I was a patrol officer for Las Vegas Metro Police, right here in Las Vegas in the mid-90s. Now, there is a big difference between policing and law enforcement. I've explained it before. I'll go into it again for those of you who are new listeners. Policing is similar to that of a peace officer, where you're there to keep the peace. Okay? Policing is one of those things that came around in the 1800s, the mid-1800s, in some of the industrial cities back east, back in Pennsylvania, New York, to try to help the law-abiding citizens who were out there during the industrial age, the Industrial Revolution, who are productive members of society, and keep the scourge of society from them. So they would police around and help the good people out. Now what you have are what is called law enforcement. What law enforcement sees their job as, there's laws on the books, and we are here to enforce these laws across the board for everybody, unless, of course, they're part of our little elite group of mainly other cops and judges and things like that, people of favoritism. There are people that we see that are above the law, so it's okay. But everybody else, the citizens who are actually the bosses, the ones in charge, the citizenry, the ultimate CEO, if you will, the ultimate chairman's chair people of the board, that's who we're going to enforce these laws on. Not here to help people out. Not here to protect people, but to enforce laws. That is the difference between policing and law enforcement. And the mindset of law enforcement is all wrong. And it's across this country at every level. I really despise the term law enforcement. But the cops sure love it. They believe that that is the bigger calling. Now, all too often, and it stems from the term law enforcement and the entire mindset that it puts these people involved in this type of work in, all too often puts these folks into a position of believing that they are the ultimate authority, when in fact, it's very, very far from the truth. There are many authorities well beyond that of a street cop, ending with the authority of us, we the people, the ones that they believe they have all the authority over. Simply reading the Constitution, the very Constitution that they raise their hand and swear to uphold, protect, and defend when they accept their commission as a police officer, that very Constitution, if they read it and understood it, they would know this. Well, about a year ago, we read a story about an officer by the name of Shandy Cobain, who was caught up in a controversy where he was kicking and stomping the hell out of a suspect who was leaving the scene of a crime. As it turns out, he had the wrong guy. But in a train station, he stomped the hell out of the guy on camera. Totally the wrong guy. So let me read this story to you. Seattle police officer Shandy Cobain is caught up in another controversy, this one dealing with the alleged manipulation of a patrol car video camera that also had audio. Just a week after Cobain was videotaped kicking a Latino suspect in the head in a high-profile incident in April of last year, he was also accused of excessive force on a young man in Belltown. Now, KIRO News Team 7, investigative reporter Chris Halsney, has uncovered there's a partial conclusion to that second case, one that potentially embarrasses the Seattle Police Department. Let's see, they say, this is the KIRO written report. They say that they've been keeping their eye on a criminal trial, one in which SPD gang detective Shandy Cobain claims he was the victim of an on-the-job assault. The victim claims are pretty much just the opposite. He accused this guy accused Officer Cobain of choking him just for fun. To settle the matter, a King County judge said, let's view the patrol car videotape to see who's right. The problem is, the relevant portion of the video and audio is nowhere to be found. Attorney Peter Connick already won a victory for his client, but his probe into how Seattle police can influence the images on their in-car cameras is far from over. It all started April 24th outside the Amber restaurant in Seattle. David Dingo said his friends were jumped by another group. Police stormed in to stop the fight. A cell phone picture shows Rango being arrested with gang unit detective Shandy Cobain in the background. Moments after the picture was taken, Rango says that while handcuffed and lying down in a patrol car, Cobain intentionally cut off his air supply by pressing his thumb into Rango's windpipe. Quote, he, Cobain, came around the driver's side, opened the door up, and just choked me until I lost. I started kicking. Because I was about to pass out. Then he let me go. I took a breath, and he choked me again, Rango told the investigative team a year ago. While Internal Affairs reviewed his complaint, the King County Prosecutor's Office pressed ahead, charging Rango for felony assault of a police officer. Cobain reported Rango pushed him, something that Rango strongly denies. Now, felony assault by pushing a cop? Okay. If he smacked him with a bat, would it be the same charge? Let's see. In court, News Team 7 investigator discovered Cobain's assault story became impossible to corroborate. Connick subpoenaed patrol car videotape and audio tape and found important pieces were missing or erased. Connick said that crucial video of that initial contact, detention, and placement in the car is missing. He added certain things were intentionally not done. This video wasn't turned on specifically, which was admitted by all officers to be a breach of protocol and procedure. There were gang unit officers who specifically told arresting officers not to give statements. That's a serious allegation, but one that King County Judge Joan Dubuque found to be true, according to court records. She not only took the unusual move of dismissing Rango's assault charge last week, but venting her frustration at the sloppy police work in a recorded courtroom conclusion. Judge Dubuque said, I have not seen a case this poorly prepared or investigated in my 22 years on the bench. Well, of course, they're wondering if it was possible for SPD officers to manipulate dash camera recordings. The short answer is yes, because the news team pulled the SPD in-car video policy. It tells officers, quote, if reasonable to do so, officers will record their approach to crime scenes and any scenes they feel could benefit from being recorded. Now, Connick says that means that police have the option to turn on their cameras and microphones. Turn them on and off at will. There's some videotape proof that of that in Rango's case. In one recording, you can see an officer start recording, then manually rotate the lens of the interior car camera to shoot to the back seat towards David Rango. Of course, they notice that when the tape starts, the car's already moving, missing the important moments before when Rango says he was choked in the back seat of the car by Officer Cobain. Rango fought for a year to clear his name in what he describes as a nightmare. He says, I didn't expect for them to behave at all like they behaved. I was shocked to be arrested. The fact that they lied about it and the tape is missing is not only that surprising because their behavior matches that. SPD was reluctant to speak about the case, of course, saying that they expect a civil lawsuit to file David Rango's criminal exoneration, as they should. They also refused to answer the technical questions about the on-off buttons on the car in-car cameras and specifics about who has access to erase tapes. Officer Cobain remains on administrative reassignment for the 12th straight month. That infamous stomping incident I talked about earlier is still under investigation. Judge Dubuque's audio-taped ruling on this case gives you a unique insight into SPD's problems with the in-car camera policy violations. Here's the deal, guys. You're dealing with the human race. You're dealing with the human race with people that have exceptional authority over the general public. And exceptionally inflated perception of that authority as well. Believing that they're the stormtroopers and they can do whatever they want. And they're in control of what evidence makes it in and doesn't. That's what we're dealing with. As a matter of fact, we're about to head up on the break. We're going to take a break, do a little bit of news, things such as that. When we come back into the hour number two, I'm going to regurgitate a conversation I had with a retired cop out of New York that I had, I don't know, sometime last year, that you will find to be the difference between the way police work should be done and the way it is generally done, and how things happen like this with this guy in Seattle. Stay tuned. I'm your host, Bill Carnes. We'll be heading into hour two after the break. We'll be right back.
Gun control, loved by dictators since 1917. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes is back.
All right, guys, welcome back for the break. So, sometime last year, I had a discussion. I had a conversation with a cop who was retired out of the state of New York. And he worked in a relatively high crime area and, served 20 plus years. And here's kind of the way the conversation went about. We were talking about how cops will change the story and change evidence to fit their personal preference on how a court case should go. And really, how it should go against somebody that they came across on the street and arrested, based, quite honestly, on what they think of the person that they arrested, rather than any evidence against them. Now, here's what this guy said. He says, I'll tell you how it went down on the street. It went down on the street, however I wrote it up in the report, and that's the way it went down. Basically meaning, it doesn't matter how things happened. It matters how I write it up as to what's going to go down officially as to how it happened, which is perjury, oppression under the color of office, violation of your oath, all kinds of problems, all kinds of felonies, every time that happens. And it happens all too often. So what I told this guy was, I'm like, huh, interesting. When I wrote reports, I did it a lot differently. So, well, how did you do it? What I would do is I would write a report based on what actually happened on the street. Not the way I thought it should have happened. Whatever actually happened is what went down in my notes, in my reports. So, he tells me a couple stories. Says something along the lines of, one case or another is on, and this, that, and the other went on. And then later they found out that these guys were dirtier than they really were. But fruits of the poisonous tree. They ended up finding out through a manner which was not prescribed by law. So they had to conjure up the way that things, they had to rewrite history and say that other things happened before they actually did. And that's what went into the report in order to get a conviction on these guys. And I looked at it and I said, that is absolutely illegal. And he says, what these guys were doing was illegal. I said, okay, here's the thing. Unfortunately, the cops have to play by the rules. The criminals don't. That's just the way it is. That helps keep the government in check, allegedly, is that the government has to play by the rules that are written. Criminals don't. But criminals are criminals. They don't play by the rules. So when the cops don't play by the rules, what happens then? If you play by the rules, then you're not a criminal. If you don't play by the rules, then you are a criminal. Right? Now, we're talking about some high-end stuff. If I remember correctly with the story, this was like a drug case. And it wasn't like a huge amount of drugs. And come on, really, drugs? I mean, it wasn't a huge amount of drugs. That, like, the second that you see them with your eyes, everybody in the neighborhood dies. It wasn't like that. Like a lot of pot or something. Come on. So I told him, I said, you know, here's the deal. I actually had a deputy district attorney ask me. I was subpoenaed to a case. It's a preliminary hearing. And before the court case, we're outside, as normally happens. Okay, going through, okay, you want go ahead and review your report and blah, blah, blah. And he says to me, he says, you know, in this report, what we're missing is, you know, da, 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 da. And I said, you're missing that because that didn't happen. And he says, well, in order to prosecute this case, we need that. And I said, no, you don't. I said, this case follows the element of the law. Every single element of the law, as written in the state law, as a violation, is right here in the report, outlined in detail. Well, the judges aren't going to convict unless there's something more on there. And I said, well, then that's a discussion for you and the judge to have. If the judge is not going to follow the state law, then that's up to the judge. I said, and if you don't think there's enough here, then you shouldn't be attempting to prosecute. He says, well, you know, this person has a long rap sheet and blah, blah, blah. Okay, well, then that's up to you. I did my job. My job is to arrest based on probable cause. Your job is to try to prosecute and prove beyond a reasonable doubt. So my level of arrest is different than your level of prosecution. And he starts telling me, look, we can have this guy if we just have da-da-da-da-da, which is missing from the report. If you can articulate that in court. And I looked at him and I said, you are doing your very best to get me to lie and perjure myself. That's perjury. It is violation of my oath of office, and what you're doing is violation of yours. And oppression under the color of office, not to mention violation of the rights of the accused. Not only will I not do that, if you say one more word about me adding something into a report in an incident that didn't happen, I will arrest you right now. And I will take you and I will book you right now. And I swear to every bit of authority that I've got, every favor that I can cash in on at the detention center, I will make sure that you are put into the general holding cell with everyone else who's been arrested so far today. At which time, he shut up and basically tossed my subpoena back at me. And I said, no, no, no. You sign that. I'm here on my day off. I get overtime for this. He says, you didn't contribute anything to this case. I'm not signing this. And I told him, I said, ah, now we're talking about theft of my personal property and negligence of your official duty. I said, it's just about time for me to pull these cuffs and slap them on you. But do as you will. He signed it. Threw it at me, and I left. Never saw the guy again. He was never assigned to another one of my cases. Imagine that. I wonder what that guy's doing now. I wish I would have kept my records that had his name. I mean, I don't know. It would have been interesting to find out what happened to this guy. He's probably district attorney now. Maybe he's an assistant sheriff or something. You never know. Anyhow, these are the sorts of things, guys, that I tell you actually happen. And the difference of why I didn't really enjoy dealing with a lot of the cop-related BS because of the way a lot of the cops wanted to remanufacture history in their reports. And the way they and a certain percentage of deputy district attorneys, assistant district attorneys, and DAs across the country would prefer you to do things to put the scumbags behind bars. That's the injustice system that's actually in place today. Stay tuned. We're going to talk about an armed Florida judge who confronted deputies outside of her home after the break. I'm your host, Bill Carnes, right here on 2A Radio.
Tell everyone in the room to pipe down. 2A Radio with Bill Carnes is back.
Welcome back from the break, everyone. Now, here's the way things work. You're on the street doing your regular everyday thing. A cop needs to have reasonable suspicion to stop and start interviewing you. They need to have probable cause. Now, reasonable suspicion to believe that you have recently engaged in criminal activity, are in the process of engaging criminal activity, or are just about to engage in criminal activity. That's what reasonable suspicion is. You don't need much for reasonable suspicion. Just kind of articulating the sixth sense, articulating the back of the hairs on the back of the neck. You need a little bit more than just the hairs on the back of the neck. Something to do with observation, behaviorism, something like that. Circumstances, what's going on. In order to arrest, you need to have probable cause. And here's the generic legal definition of probable cause. Probable cause exists when the facts and circumstances known to the officer would warrant a prudent man to believe that a crime had been committed and that the accused had committed it. That's what you need to arrest. And of course, to arrest on a specific crime, there are elements of that crime that need to be met. If this happened, or this plus this, or this plus this, or that, and this, or this, that, and the other, the way that things are written, has to meet what are called the elements of the crime. For instance, in the state of Nevada, if you enter into an occupied structure with the intent to commit assault, battery, grand larceny, or petty larceny, you have committed the felony act of burglary. Meaning, I'm going to walk into that store, or I'm going to walk into this place, and I'm going to punch this guy in the mouth. I'm going to walk into this bar, and I'm going to punch some guy into the mouth. Okay, so you walk in there, and boom, you punch him, you leave. You've just committed burglary by the law in the state of Nevada. Because before you walked in, you had intent to commit assault or battery, grand larceny or petty larceny. Which I think in Nevada is $500 is the difference between grand larceny and petty larceny. That's what it used to be. I think it's the same. Or if you say, okay, I'm going to walk into the local Stab and Grab convenience store, and I'm going to steal me a pack of gum because I got some really funky, stank breath. I'm going to grab me some chewing gum. You go in there, take the gum, and you leave. It isn't petty larceny. Because before you walked in, you decided you were going to do that. It's a felony. It's burglary. Now, this is the type of cop I was. I generally work the majority of my time on Metro. I work swing shift from 3 in the afternoon till 1 a.m. in some pretty active, dirtbag-ridden crime areas of Vegas. And it was busy. It was fun. The last area I worked was day shift in Mom and Popville. Hated it. There was nothing going on. Oftentimes, I would get called to the local Target or Walmart or Kmart on these in-custody petty larceny cases where store security observes somebody stealing something. They hook them up. You go in. The way you normally handle it, you go in there. You Mirandize the person as the cop. You're in the security office. You Mirandize the suspect. You find out if they have any wants or warrants. If the answer is no, you write them a ticket for petty larceny, hand it to them, they sign it. You give them a citation. They're supposed to show up in court 2 or 3 weeks later, whatever the court date is that you assigned. Now, that's the easy way of doing it. Well, since I had a lot of time on my hands, there's a bunch of other cops, and nobody was doing anything because there's nothing going on. What I would do is I would interview the suspects if they waive their rights to Miranda. I'd get all this on videotape. And if they articulate, if they said through questioning that they knew that they were going to commit the crime before they walked into the store, and they had a rap sheet of a bunch of larcenies, a bunch of thefts, a bunch of petty larcenies, if they are a habitual thief, I would do the longer, drawn-out process and arrest them on felony burglary. Case in point. There was a guy that walked into a Kmart and was going to steal, I forget what it was, something electronic that was valued about $85, a petty larceny. I go in, I'm met by security at the front door. They're walking me to the back, and I ask them what they have. The guy tells me what he has and that they have the entire episode from the moment this guy walked into the store, his entire time in the store until they stopped him. They have everything on video. So I asked him to loop all of that onto one video cassette. And as soon as we got to the security office, I wanted them to roll tape the entire time I was in there until I asked them to stop rolling tape. And at the end of that, I may ask them to include that onto the end of this tape that they were going to make a reel of. So I go in there. I introduce myself as Officer Carnes, Las Vegas Metro Police. Let him know why I'm there. Then I read him his Miranda rights right off of a card. Ask him if he's willing to answer questions. He says, yes, I understand my rights. I will waive my rights. Excellent. So I start interviewing the guy. In the interview, he tells me, I was on a bus. When I was going to get off the bus, I wanted to either get drunk or get high. This is an older guy. So I decided I was going to come to this Kmart and steal something and try to sell it or trade it for some booze or some drugs. And I asked him, when did you come to this decision that you were going to steal something from the Kmart? While on the bus. And how long was that before you actually entered into the Kmart? He said, at least 10 or 15 minutes before I came here, I knew that my plan was to come in here and steal something and leave. Okay. Then I called up wants and warrants. This was on a Thursday. The Sunday before, 4 days ago, he was arrested for grand larceny. 2 days later, 2 days prior to this, on Tuesday, he was released on his own recognizance with a court date for the grand larceny. So, oh, and a huge arrest record for theft. Okay, great. I've got a burglary here. So, I go through all the stuff, let this guy know he's being arrested for felony burglary. Then I have the security manager. I say, okay, take this tape that we've had, add that onto the end of the loop. I'll wait for the tape. A couple minutes later, I have the tape in hand. I book this guy on burglary. I enter the videotape into evidence. I do the long, drawn-out felony form, and I arrest the guy. This is the third time in about 2 weeks I've done this. I get a call from a detective a few days later, and he says, are you the guy that keeps arresting people on felonies when they've been stopped for petty larceny? I said, yeah. You got a problem with that? And he said, no. I wish more cops would actually investigate and do this. These guys keep getting run through the mill, and we can't get anything done. So I said, keep me in the loop on this. He calls me about 3 weeks later and says, here's the deal. We pled your burglary out. It's gone. It was a good case, elements of the law. And he says, you did a wonderful job in us being able to get this. He pled on the grand larceny charge. He's going to do a year. Had you not done the extra effort and done this guy on a burglary the way that you should have and the way you did, this guy probably would have got 30 days, maybe even time served, a fine, community service, something. Instead, this lifelong thief has finally got a felony on his record, which he's never had before. Good job to you, Carnes. Good. That's the way I did my job. Just an idea of the way that things generally don't happen in the police field, but can if you find the occasional good guy cop. Yes, I was a good guy cop. We are going to get to this armed Florida judge after the break. Stay tuned. I'm your host, Bill Carnes. You're tuned in right here to 2A Radio.
Your right to listen and take action shall not be infringed. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes is back.
Hi, guys. Welcome back from the break. You know, I started to get to this at the last segment, and that is the cops need reasonable suspicion to stop you or a consensual stop. They can ask you if you want to talk. And your answer can be, no, don't have time. Kind of like a consensual search. Here's the deal. Like, people say, well, if the cop asks if he can search my car, and I tell him no, then what he's going to do is say, well, because you said no, that means you must have something to hide, so now I'm going to search it. So I just say, yes, go ahead and search the car. It doesn't work like that, guys. If that ever happens, police officer stops you. Do I have permission to search your vehicle? The answer, every single time without fail, is no. You do not have my permission to search this car. Now, if it's ever going to happen where a cop says, you know what, that must mean that you're hiding something, so I'm going to search it anyhow. No. If they do search it and they find anything, it's called fruits of the poisonous tree, it's completely inadmissible, you'll probably get arrested, you'll probably go to jail. And then what you do is you just, look, fruits of the poisonous tree, I did not give this cop permission, and then this is how he went about it. Got to fight it, but, you know, that's the way it works, to win. Anyhow, reasonable suspicion to stop and talk with you. Probable cause to arrest you. You need to have proof beyond a reasonable doubt to convict you. Okay, so proof beyond a reasonable doubt is that up to a judge. Judges are there to interpret the law. The legislative branch passes the law. The executive branch enforces the law. The judicial branch interprets the law. Okay? And sometimes they interpret the law to be unconstitutional and they smack it down. So the judge, really being kind of the final authority in this deal, is the one that really understands what goes on. And they see all kinds of garbage that happens on the streets when it comes to cops. I have seen more cops on the stand perjure themselves, lying by recreating history and timelines to serve their purpose of conviction than any other standard affair in a court of law. Cops lying is the standard fare. And they all use the same terminology. The assistant district attorneys, the DAs, and the cops all have this standard affair. It's like if they arrest you for marijuana, well, I observed a green leafy substance believed to be marijuana. It's always a green leafy substance believed to be marijuana. If you actually look at marijuana, it doesn't appear to be very leafy at all. It's rather ground up, in fact, because people who smoke weed don't smoke the leaves. They smoke the little buds that come off of the leaves. That's what comes out. And they call it a green leafy substance believed to be marijuana. That's an almost universal term. It's all coaching. Garbage. Well, an armed Florida judge confronted deputies outside of her Deerfield home. The Broward Circuit Court judge, Alona Holmes, came out packing heat when armed sheriff's deputies showed up at her sister's Deerfield Beach home last Sunday evening, according to an official report. A communication mix-up led to deputies mistakenly surrounding the home in the 200 block of Southwest 4th Street at about 8:20 p.m. on Easter Sunday in response to a neighbor's call about a suspected burglary, according to the report. Meanwhile, Judge Holmes and her family had been alerted about a possible break-in and thought approaching deputies might be the burglars. Revolver in hand, Judge Holmes exited the house with family members, repeatedly saying, "I'm Judge Holmes. I'm Judge Holmes." The judge told deputies she, quote, felt that had she not been there, police would have mistreated her family. That's according to a Broward Sheriff's Office report on the incident. According to the report, Holmes eventually put her weapon down, but refused with her family members to sit on the grass. Because the sheriffs are coming up and saying, look, we don't know who you are. This is what we're going to do. Is we're going to find out if you're supposed to be here. Okay, reasonable assumption based on the burglary. But here's the deal. Judge Holmes and her family are black. So now the cops are in this neighborhood seeing a bunch of blacks in a house that they are hearing is potentially being burglarized. She's saying she's a judge and has a gun. What are they going to do? They're not going to quite buy that so quick. Just the way these sheriff's deputies are doing their thing. Well, after the situation was diffused, the judge went back inside and declined to speak to the deputy preparing the official report. She said she was soaking her feet, the report says. Judge Holmes could not be reached for comment earlier this week, despite a couple of phone calls. Her attorney, Kendall Coffey, said he's been in contact with the sheriff's officer's lawyers to discuss the incident. So I'm hoping to find out a little bit more information about what went on here. Why the neighbors called up and said there was an alleged burglar. Maybe the neighbors don't like him. Maybe the neighbors are stupid. Maybe they got the address wrong. I don't know. All kinds of things could have happened on this case. But the judge came out thinking that that might be burglars, and she has a gun in her hand. Now, in general situation, she's probably a little bit lucky she didn't get shot. Why? Because when cops come up on a suspected burglary case, you see somebody standing there with a gun, you're more inclined to shoot. Is that right? Not necessarily. But the cops will always argue, officer safety. You know what? It's everyone's safety. Cops argue officer safety all the time, but they're under no legal obligation to have to provide safety to any individual citizen anywhere in the United States, as adjudicated by the United States Supreme Court back in about 1985, 86, I forget when it was. They don't have to protect anybody, but officer safety is very important to them. And officer safety also means getting out from behind cover concealment and walking straight up to somebody. Far more people in this country who are shot by cops wouldn't get shot by cops if they actually employed very basic and very standard time-tested tactics. You pull up to a house, suspected burglars, and you see somebody in the front lawn with a gun, you don't just get out of your car and approach them with your gun drawn walking into them. Stay behind the engine block. About 3 to 4 feet behind the car, so that if you are shot at and the bullet hits the hood, the angle of deflection isn't going to rick that bullet and deflect it into you. It's going to go over your head. You need distance behind your cover. So that's the way this judge went. Let's talk a little bit just for a moment about this distance behind your cover. It's very common, tactically speaking, for people to crowd their cover, move right up on it. You've seen it in the movies and TV. People run up to a brick wall, boom, slam into the brick wall, gun up around their face, right? The Charlie's Angels look so you can see both the gun and the hot chick's face at the same time. People think this is an actual tactic. It's not. Then they peek around the corner. Now, here's the deal. When you shoot at something, you're going to get penetration or you're going to get deflection. We're not talking about ricochets. We're talking deflection. We're talking about where it hits something, and rather than penetrating, it bounces off. We're talking about a penetrable sort of material. It either gets penetrated or it gets deflected if the angle is not severe enough to penetrate. Regardless of the angle it enters, it will deflect it 3 to 5 degrees. I've actually done ballistics tests with a couple of guys on this. We've shot meat and all kinds of stuff. 3 to 5 degree angle. That means if you're behind cover, now the difference between cover and concealment, cover is bulletproof, concealment is not. In this day and age, far less things are cover than concealment. You need to be about 4 feet back from your bulletproof cover. Because people could, if you're right up on it, people could shoot the cover, the bullet deflects, the rick comes up in the from the deflection, and boom, hits you. Not good. So what you want is about 4 feet back, so that if they hit the, imagine like shooting from using the engine block of a car and they hit the hood, you want to be far enough back that if they shoot the hood, it doesn't rick off of the hood, deflect off and hit you. It goes over your head. Stay tuned. More to come after the break. We'll be right back.
If you live in a state which allows Class 3 NFA firearms and accessories, and you either have an interest in or already own Class 3 NFA items, the process for an individual to own these items includes photographs, fingerprints, obtaining a letter of permission from your police chief or sheriff, and a full personal background check, which is spread across the whole federal system. Until now. Forming an NFA trust eliminates the requirements of letters of permission and all personal data and background checks in purchasing and possessing NFA firearms and accessories. NFA trusts offer a level of anonymity as well as flexibility in the purchasing, possessing, and storage of your Class 3 NFA firearms and accessories. To learn more about forming a secure and flexible NFA trust at a fraction of the cost earned from attorneys, visit www.billcarnes.com and click on the NFA tab. That's BILLCARNS.com and click on the NFA tab.
As long as politicians attack our rights, Bill will be fighting for them. Two-Way Radio with Bill Carnes is back.
Back off, I'll take you on. Headstrong to take on anyone. I know that you are wrong if this is not where you belong.
Welcome back, everyone. Now, the state that is number one on the list of the Brady campaign for progressive firearms controls would be the state of California, meaning that it's number 50 on the list of pro-gunners. Anything that's number one with anti-gunners is number last place with pro-gunners. Well, California is about as anti-gun as you can get. As a matter of fact, the bill that was supposed to go into effect just a couple months back in February, which had huge restrictions on how much ammo you could, 50 rounds of ammo a month per caliber, you got to do fingerprints and leave an ID and blah, 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 blah. Well, in the 11th hour before that law was to go into effect, it was ruled completely unconstitutional by a judge that the anti-gunners thought was for sure going to be in the bag and saying, yes, it's constitutional. So it was thrown out. And, of course, the anti-gunners at the state legislature have been trying to find a way to rewrite the law so that they can pass it. Well, here's the deal. A lot of people have just written California off. Say, you know what? I just forget about them. Well, Second Amendment advocates really have a lot to be proud of in California so far this legislative session. Now, I'm going to read to you a quote, which is by the rather hypocritical Abraham Lincoln. We the people are the rightful masters of both Congress and the courts, not to overthrow the Constitution, but to overthrow the men who pervert the Constitution. Interesting, coming from a guy who the southern states exercise their constitutional authority to secede from the Union and start the Confederate States of America, and Abraham Lincoln said, oh no, we can't have that. Anyhow, despite the generally held view that Second Amendment rights are pretty much a lost cause in California, the gun rights activists in California have quite a lot to be proud of, as well as gun rights advocates across the country, because of their fellow supporters in the Golden State. With the defeat of every gun control bill in the state legislature in 2010, including the highly controversial open carry ban, AB 1934, Second Amendment advocates on the West Coast and all across the country can celebrate the newfound momentum and renewed vigor with which Californians approach the subject of gun rights in this modern era. Following the national trend of the gun control lobby's dramatically diminished reliance in modern American politics, relevance, The decades-long encroachment against every common law-abiding citizen's Second Amendment rights in California has been stopped cold throughout 2010 and is striking progress towards being made this year as well in 2011. A really brilliant example of this sudden turnaround in Second Amendment advocacy in California occurred fairly recently in the small city of Pleasant Hill, a Bay Area suburb with a population of about 33,000. At 7:30 p.m. on a nondescript Tuesday night of April 26, 2011, just last week, a large contingent of Second Amendment supporters in California packed the city hall of Pleasant Hill until it was standing room only to protest the backdoor attempts by the Brady campaign to screw everybody in California out of owning a gun, I think that's their official name, and their legal affiliate, the Legal Community Against Violence, to push tax-paying and law-abiding gun dealers out of the city in a concentrated effort to force an unpopular gun control agenda down the throats of the local community. Had it not been for the efforts of Pleasant Hill resident Wendy Lack, San Francisco Bay Area residents would have been largely unaware of the developments that were progressing beyond the scope of public disclosure. In an article published in Halfway to Concord, Lack describes, quote, how over the past several months, City of Pleasant Hill officials have been quietly planning to adopt new regulations to limit firearms and ammunition sales in the city. Imagine that. They want to do something which is unpopular that serves their specific small-minded interest and not open to the public. It's been very, very quiet. She continued with, during the past 6 months, Pleasant Hill City Council members and City Council candidates were contacted by Karen Anzarin from the California Brady Campaign, a 501c3 organization, seeking to reduce, quote, gun violence and educate the public about gun violence through litigation, grassroots mobilization, and outreach to affect communities, which means a whole bunch of nothing. During this period, Artzen made contact with city officials and met with council members David Durant and Michael Harris for the purpose of discussing new regulation of firearms and ammunition sales in Pleasant Hills. So it's the Brady campaign to prevent gun violence. But what are they doing? They're going after the legal means for law-abiding citizens to get guns and ammo. So they're liars. On February 7th, 2011, the City Council approved Mayor David Durant's request to form an ad hoc public health and safety subcommittee composed of Durant, Councilmember Michael Harris, City Manager June Catalano, and Police Chief Peter Dunbar, or his designee when needed. At that council meeting, the safety committee's role was established to, quote, advise the council, make recommendations on future programs and policies, or suggest revisions to existing programs. Now, here's the deal. The Public Health and Safety Subcommittee. This is what happens here. The government regulates stuff if they can articulate a way to put it into the narrow heading of public safety or public health. Give you an example. The banning of trans fats in New York City, or the banning of trans fats in schools, right? So they're getting away with this in a lot of ways. It's your body. It's your temple. Do with it as you please. If you want to put trans fat in your body because that makes food taste good, go ahead. Is it healthy for you? Studies say that it's not. Studies say cigarettes aren't healthy for you. Does that mean that they should just ban tobacco? Well, they're saying that gun violence is a public health crisis. Does that mean that they could ban guns based on public health? Huh. You can see where this is going. Well, ad hoc committees are not subject to California Brown Act open meeting rules, enabling public officials and staff to meet privately without notice, without agendas, without meeting minutes, without public input. Ad hoc committees, by definition, convene for a limited period of time and have no continuing subject matter jurisdiction other than what's defined. Since formation of the Safety Committee, questions have arisen regarding whether the ad hoc designation was made properly. Suspicions remain whether the ad hoc designation was used as a procedural ruse to allow consideration of controversial firearms regulation outside of the public view. Do you think that elected officials would do something like that? Well, with lax assistance, community organizer, Alani Helmerontor was able to provide these facts to local gun rights groups regarding this unconstitutional proposal and bring to light the fact that two local businesses would be negatively impacted by these newly proposed regulations. Diablo Valley Gunworks has been a local business and pillar within the Pleasant Hill community since 1978. During the 33 years that Diablo Valley Gunworks has been in business, there has never been a problem with violent crime stemming from the retail business or its location. Although City Arms LLC has only been in business in Pleasant Hill for approximately 1 year, there's never been any issue regarding violent crime stemming from that business either. When local Second Amendment groups caught wind of these anti-gun developments that they were occurring in Pleasant Hill, they quickly presented this news to their members, and a rapid response was coordinated to present the gun rights side of the debate of the City of Pleasant Hill's Planning Commission. Representatives from Responsible Citizens of California, NorCal Open Carry, Contra Costa Open Carry, East Bay Tea Party, and Cal Guns attended the meeting last Tuesday night to express their opposition to these new gun restriction proposals. In addition, citizens from all over the Bay Area attended as well. All told, there were 113 concerned citizens that packed into the place. 60 filled out comment cards to speak on the issue. 56 of the 60 said, "This is unconstitutional, it sucks, and we don't want to hear it." What happened in Pleasant Hill? They caved. Thanks, guys. We'll be back next week.
I'd like to close by saying, to those of you within our government, we will be watching you. Congress, the executive, and judicial branches all very closely as we organize to save our freedom, liberty, and country. We will not become the subjects of governmental rule.
Thanks for tuning in. Bill will be back tomorrow. Now go side in and shoot straight. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes. Learn more about Bill at BillCarnes.com. Send your comments to Bill@2aradio.com.
I will not break. I will show.